Who's up for talking nonsense?
Who's up for talking nonsense?
I'm the American Jezebel.
This is the Greasy Rapidian. And?
So exciting. Two episodes in a row, we have a special in-studio guest.
And who do we, you can introduce?
We have a new guest this week. She is known about town as the Physicista.
The Physicista?
The Physicista is here.
Hello. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on the show in our new studio setup.
New studio setup.
It's really exciting, yeah.
And she maybe could tell us how we're sitting.
Well, we're sitting around a red dining room table with two microphones set up, and we're very excited to be here.
What direction would you... How are we positioned one against the other? What is a phrase that some people apparently use to describe these things?
The Physicista has said that she uses this phrase.
Yes, in a different way. We are across from each other, which some would call orthogonal.
Yes, we are sitting orthogonal, Joe Rogan style.
Mm-hmm. He's really trying to make, it's like Fetch in Mean Girls. He's just trying to make orthogonal happen, and nobody wants to make it happen. It's not going to happen, Gretchen.
No, it's going to happen like tire pugs.
Yeah, he has, the Greasy Rapinian is well known for trying to make phrases happen. There were other ones too, but.
Uh-huh. A fizzard, when they predict a storm and it doesn't happen, it's a fizzard.
You have had some more successful ones though, like Shoverdose.
Yeah.
Shoverdose, I think, is one of your more successful phrases. Yes.
So I do have, and I think orthogonal is like, it's legitimate. It's just like not made up.
That's true, but I just don't think people use it as colloquially as you think that they do.
Physicista?
Yet.
Yet.
I like that you're taking a side on this one. Well, welcome to the show, Physicista. We're super glad to have you here. Mm-hmm.
And you came in a show that is sponsored by... Who is our future sponsor for this
we
show with the Physicista?
We are propelled this morning. We all had some of it before starting the show.
Correct.
So yes, today's show is propelled by Owen. Only what you need.
Only what you need. And so last time we had a whole ad campaign that we were going to have the anarcho-syndicalists do, but we didn't spend any time like usual on the copy. And so we did the same today. So Physicista, would you talk about our sponsor, Owen?
Well, as we know, Owen stands for Only What You Need, and it is a pea protein powder shake. And the three of us each tried the different flavors. I had dark chocolate, the Greasy Rapidian had strawberry banana, and the American Jezebel had cold brew. And it was fabulous for the most part. Our verdict is that they're trying really hard.
Yes.
Their official tagline.
Yes. I think it would go really down really well in Australia.
And Sweden, only what you need.
Only what you need.
Enough is a feast.
Yes, enough is as good as a feast. The official tagline of the country of Sweden.
It might be produced in Sweden. They might be producing Owen in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we know that some of the other things in this company are produced in other parts of Europe. So
yeah.
I do think it could be produced in Sweden.
Could have even been produced near where our movie for this week was filmed.
Ooh.
Which brings us to, what are we watching this week?
Yeah, so thank you to Owen for giving us the calories to get through this episode. Yep. Yes, propelling the nonsense. Let's talk about the movie. Mm-hmm. So what movie did we watch this week?
We watched...
Call Me By Your Name.
And this was a film that I had seen previously, but that neither the Greasy Rapidian nor the Physicista had ever seen before. So before we actually sat down and watched the movie, we had them sit down and make some predictions in our recurring segment. What is this movie about?
So neither I nor the Physicista have seen this movie. Would you like to go first, or would you like me to go first?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. So, full disclosure, I know three things about this movie. I know that it stars Timothée Chalamet or something like that. His name I can never say. And he had to miss Paw Patrol to attend the Oscars. So I'm thinking he's pretty young. And so I know that. I know that it was Oscar nominated because he was there. So that's the second thing I know about it. And I know that it is a gay love story. The three things I know about it. So I'm going to say what this movie is about is that these two attend the same high school. So I'm going to say they're both seniors. And so they attend the same high school and they are social misfits. They don't fit in with the predominant culture of the school. And at some point during their senior year, they find each other. And they happen to share the same name, although derivatives of the same name. And so I don't think they're going to be Robert or Robbie's, but they might be Donald and Donnie's or something of that nature. And they then start a friendship based on their mutual exclusion from dominant culture. And so one of the Donald Donnies is romantically attracted to the other. And as their friendship deepens and their relationship deepens, they have this brief encounter with a romantic relationship. But then one of them realizes that that's not his path in this life. And so he has to tell his other one that, I love you like this, but I don't love you like that. And so he says to him, the other one says, yes, I've realized that, but you can still call me by your name. And then they go off to college right after prom, as they do in these movies. So that's what I think this movie is about. It's a liminal space as one of them moves into this liminal space of exploring his sexuality and then moves out of it into a different place.
Very nice.
Okay.
Very nice.
And what do you think this movie is about?
Well, the things I know about this movie are that it involves a song by Sufjan Stevens called The Mystery of Love. And it involves a nice house. And I think this movie is about a father-son reunion.
Wait, so you've had it pretty much summed up. I mean,
there's only one option.
Yeah, I mean, the movie can only go one way.
Exactly.
Nice house and a song by somebody I don't know.
Yep. It's for sure a father-son story.
Okay.
So, father and son have a very close relationship. The son is 15, and they go on a week-long backpacking trip to British Columbia. They plan it all out. They're very prepared and experienced. It's all going just splendid until there's a devastating storm. Their campsite floods just with this torrent of water that is incredibly powerful, and it sweeps sweeps the father and son away in different directions, and both suffer amnesia from hitting their heads on rocks at various points in this journey. So each wakes up in a different hospital in different cities and does not know who he is, where he is, who his family is, and each has to try to rebuild his life based on where he happened to land, until each starts to remember certain things and feel a yearning for that father figure or a yearning for that child. And so they begin a parallel journey of trying to find the other. And when they do, the father says to the son, "You can call me by your name." They have the same name because they are related.
Nailed it.
And then they move into a really nice house and they sing a song together about the mystery of their love for each other. So that's what's going to happen.
We could ask the American Jezebel to read us what they say the movie's about, but I don't think we really need to, do
no.
we?
No.
Yeah, I think we pretty much good. But like, yeah. We just wrapped this episode up right now.
I mean, nailed there's it. Nothing left to say. predicted everything.
Yeah, it really, you guys, I was so impressed when you guys sat down and recorded your predictions, because I was like, man, they have no idea what's happening. And based on the title and these little pieces of information, they know exactly what happens in this movie.
And I think we did. So that ends the podcast, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. I swear I didn't cheat and look it up on the internet.
And we do have to do our podcast shout out, which is...
Who are we shouting out?
Amber Says What?
That's not a podcast, though. I wish it was a podcast.
Yeah, I wish it was,
too. I wish she started a podcast.
I wish she would call us.
I know. Amber, almost more than Amber Joel Ruffin. Courtney, to be honest. Joel Courtney, we still want you to call us.
Call us, Joel.
Yes, but Amber Ruffin, you're the queen of the world. Uh-huh. Please call us. You're not the queen. You're the sun that lights up the world.
Yes. A radiant, glorious beauty.
Yes. Her humor and lightness. Yes. Just brightens the world. It would be a dark, dark world without you, Amber Ruffin.
Physicista, do you know Amber Ruffin?
I'm not familiar. Could you fill me in?
Well, no, not on the show, but we will have you watch some YouTube
off air.
Clips.
Yeah. Yes.
And you too will become a ruffian.
Oh, yes. Hashtag ruffians. Oh, yeah. So we'll show you some Amber Ruffin material off air. But everyone else should go on YouTube and look up Amber Ruffin. Specifically, Amber Says What.
Amber Says What?
Yes. So she's just a ray of sunshine.
All right. Well, on the off chance that neither one of us actually did get what the movie was about, what do they say about this movie on the website that we don't name because they made us try to buy this one? We are so sorry.
We apologize to our listeners, to all the Debbies out there.
Yeah.
We are adjusting our so that we're looking up beforehand, before the night before, how we can actually watch this movie, because the last couple of episodes we have been incorrect in how easy it was to watch the movie.
Yes.
So in the future we will look this up beforehand and let you all know how to find the movie.
Uh-huh. So we became 7-day members of a movie service so we could watch this movie for free.
I do recommend, and we still get 6 more days, and there's lots of movies to watch. So
there are, including Lava Girl and Shark Boy.
You are 100% gonna unironically watch The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl. Oh, yes, with baby Taylor Lautner in it.
When he was still being cast.
I will
in
give you my login information for this streaming service so that you can watch The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl. But on the off chance that you guys, or even to combine the two predictions that you both made, I'm going to go ahead and read you both the description of the movie, and we can talk about how accurate we feel that description is. And for those of you who watch the movie and maybe made your own predictions, you can weigh yours against it. So the official description of this movie is... It's the summer of 1983, and precocious 17-year-old Elio Perlman is spending the days with his family at their 17th-century villa in Lombardy, Italy. He soon meets Oliver, a handsome doctoral student who's working as an intern for Elio's father. Amid the sun-drenched splendor of their surroundings, Elio and Oliver discover the heady beauty of awakening desire over the course of a summer that will alter their lives forever.
I think that pretty well describes the movie, but our descriptions were better.
Yeah, I would have watched your movie much sooner than I would read this description and watch it. And did it actually live up to that? So having watched the movie, changed their lives forever. A bit of a stretch. He got a new haircut and the other dude got married. Is that changing your life forever?
I think it might have changed Elio's life more than Oliver's too, because this is more of a liminal space movie for Elio.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You think so? So we won't jump to Shark and get to the end of the series right now, but that part stood out to me, and you'll have to read it again to me because the other part now I've forgotten. It must be that Owen shake going to my head.
It hasn't quite sunk in yet.
That's right. That's what's happening. So, I haven't got to the calories.
Yes, exactly. The calories are still making their way into your body. The summer of 1983, precocious 17-year-old Elio Perlman spending the days with his family.
I'm agreeing to all of that.
Okay.
That's a good description.
He meets Oliver, a handsome doctoral student who's working as an intern for Elio's father.
Okay. I guess we could agree with that.
He's not. You would not call him handsome?
He's not my cup of tea.
I think he's pretty conventionally handsome.
Okay, conventionally. Yes. We should throw that in there.
Yes, you can say he's not your type. He's not my type either.
Okay.
But I think he's pretty conventionally handsome. Would you agree?
I would also agree.
Would you say he's handsome?
Also not my type, but okay. I think the majority of people would agree.
This might lead to a new segment. Who in the movie was your type?
Oh, that is a good question.
Mafalda.
The old man who catches the fish. He had a good sense of humor. He was enjoying life. Yes.
Okay, continue.
Okay. Amid the sun-drenched splendor of their surroundings, Elio and Oliver discover the heady beauty of awakening desire over the course of a summer.
Okay, I'm going to... That's the one. The heady beauty of awakening desire. That's a little thick for what happened. I'm going to take exception to that.
How would you describe it?
How would I describe it? I think at one, not to get ahead, but at one point, the conventionally handsome grad student describes himself as an animal. I would describe it as the animalistic plunge into desire.
They did go swimming a lot.
Nicely done. there was lots of plunging.
They were leaping into
uncharted waters.
Yeah, exploration. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I don't think it was heady beauty at all. I think it was pure desire.
Yeah, I think that's what this movie really is about. Because like the other movies that we have talked about in our cinematography trilogy, not a lot of plot in this movie either. Not a lot of things happen, right? There's a lot of scene to scene. Oh, we caught a fish. Oh, I'm writing music. Oh, we're talking about these statues. Oh, we're going to go see some statues. We're going to go swimming. We're going to eat some dinner. We're going to talk politics. So there's not a lot of overarching plot that happens in this movie, just like a lot of our other cinematography films. Mm-hmm.
I believe he even says in the movie, what do you do here? Wait for summer to end.
Yes, I did write that in my notes, that he does seem to be waiting around a lot for things to happen. Like he's just idly wandering through the house, picking up different things, looking for something to do. And even talking about a little bit of the cinematography, I do feel like, because it's so like lushly shot, right? There's all of these shots of, the countryside, the Italian countryside. And there's like a lot of times where there's not music over it. It's just the sound of like what that actual place sounds like.
Cows.
Like cows, cows and birds and crickets and like the wind blowing through the leaves is just like, here is the sound of the Italian countryside. And we're just going to look at it too. And it's like really beautiful. And especially when it's like sunny, it's almost like heavy too. You know, like when they're biking, it's almost like they're like biking. They're like, it's so thirsty because they're biking through this like heavy, dense, like lush landscape. And so you can almost feel like they're moving so slowly through it. It's almost like syrupy how slowly everything moves through, which is also like the, what we'll talk about, peaches and apricots, talking about syrupy. Yes. So everything about it is just slow and like heavy, but not in like a sad heavy way, just like everything is moving so slowly and so measuredly through the whole thing.
You don't think it is a sadness?
That's a good question. I don't think that like especially the cinematography and the shots of like the countryside and the house, I don't know that there's necessarily a lot of sadness to that. But I think there is like there's definitely some sorrow in the movie as well, in some of the other parts of it.
So oftentimes when you have these kind of pastoral movies of, you know, we're leaving America and going to these places where things are much older and much more entrenched, and there's like this kind of feeling of, wow, this is what it means to be in this rich place with this kind of deep history, and oh, only if we could go there and meld with them, right? There's this sense, Under the Tuscan Sun or whatever, those kind of movies, right? Mm-hmm. did you have the sense in this movie, like, wow, I really want to go be in that villa with those families?
In some ways, yes. It was very luxurious and just passing lazy days in the beautiful weather. But I agree with the kind of sluggish, slow aspect of it. I feel like it could have been easy to get bored.
Mm-hmm. There was a heaviness to it. And so I'm saying that the heaviness was sadness.
Mm-hmm. I see it as a mix of excitement about this awakening and this new relationship, but also mixed with an underlying sadness that it has to end, and that so many people would not approve of this relationship.
Okay, so even at the end, because we're just going to go right in now.
All the spoilers all the time. Yeah. We're not going to progress through the movie, because we've talked about generally what it's about. So they're in the Italian countryside, and the new grad student comes, and he doesn't like the grad student, and then he realizes he actually kind of does like the grad student, and then over a long period of time, they kind of discover their desire for each other, and then the grad student has to leave at the end. Broad strokes, what happens?
That was very, very good. Right? at the end, the father says, you know, I almost had a friendship like you had. And he calls it a friendship, right? And the father knows it's more than a friendship. And at one point, he even says, I've spoken out of turn, and this is more than a friendship. You know, I don't know. But, you know, and then he goes on to say how he almost had it once, but he didn't. And then once you miss the opportunity to have it, you may never have that opportunity again. And so it seems as though the father has been married to the mother for a long time. But it seems to be that he doesn't seem to think that that relationship for him has the same power and depth of some mysterious other relationship that he didn't actually consummate. And so he's just living his life with this kind of albatross of sadness for not having done that. And then he kind of lives out his life that way. And so he studies these ancient Greek or Roman statues of young boys. And then he just like talks about the position of their body, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's kind of intellectual eroticism for him as he tries to recapture something he's lost. And so it's this heady sadness, not heady beauty. And even young Elio, you know, and his relationship to music, his relationship to literature, it seems to be heady sadness. And then even the mother, when she sits down to read the German poems, right? It's these just sad, sad poems, you know? And so everything about them is sadness. And so we didn't get to hear the mother's take, you know, and what is the sad albatross that she's carrying. But I think she is.
Do you think that Oliver and Elio were able to create an oasis from this sadness?
I'm still unclear why they're attracted to each other. And I think there's one brief moment in the movie where they sit out on a balcony or a tree limb or something, and Oliver says, I've come out here every night for hours, you know, and they sit and they have this little conversation between them. And I think it's the only part of the movie where you say, oh, they actually have some kind of actual relationship. Other than we desire each other, but we shouldn't be with each other. And now I'll pretend not to like him, and he'll pretend like to not like me. And should I write him a note? Should he not? And there's just like no sense that they have any relationship other than this desire for each other. And so the whole thing, I was like, when the father was like, you had this great friendship, I was like, what great friendship? They said like four things to each other. You know, I had no sense that they had any depth of relationship besides physical. And so is that what the father so dramatically wanted? Some kind of, you know, forbidden physical relationship, you know, or to go back to the days when it was okay for, you know, a very well-respected masculine men to have boys as lovers, and he missed those times. If only I could have lived in those times and I could be that. I don't know. I was just like, I'm not sure what, you know, the great gift that the relationship was to either one of them.
I agree that it seemed more like intense infatuation than something that could be sustained for a long period of time.
Or even life-changing. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it was life-changing.
I think it could have been life-changing for Elio because he, unlike his father, allowed himself and didn't hold himself back from having this relationship. Oliver, I'm not so sure since he is getting married in the end.
Yeah, and I think that there's there's a really interesting like play between like interiority and exteriority in this movie, because I know that it's adapted from a book, and I think I was reading something about it and they were saying that the book is all from Elio's perspective, and that it would, when somebody read the book, they were like, how could you adapt this into a movie? Because it really just is him just like watching Oliver. Like, it's a movie about longing. And, you know, he starts to like say, oh, what does it mean that he wears this color of shorts this day? Like, I think it's a sign. So there really isn't a conversation between them. And I think that that's what carries over into the film is like, yeah, when I was looking for like best lines of the movie, the only like time that people are really saying things are at the end when his father gives him the speech. That's kind of like, this is the thesis of the movie. Right. But other than that, it's not about the dialogue and the plot that's happening. Right. They're not really saying a lot of things. It's a movie that's about, yeah, they never really do have a conversation, right? But it's this movie of, or so much of it is Elio just watching Oliver and looking at him and just, I think, projecting a lot of things onto him. So I don't think it's a relationship that's founded on friendship. I don't think that they're friends. But it is really, it is interesting because it is like interiority and exteriority, right? Because so much of it is like there, we don't see like what they're thinking. And so sometimes it's so hard to read because we're just, you know, just getting this glimpse of what they're doing or how they're looking at each other. And then there's also these sort of exterior pressures, because it is, it's so interesting that I know a lot of people who really like this movie because it's a gay love story in which there is no trauma that is exteriorly visited upon the people in the movie. So like when they're in the, they're on the trip together and they're walking around the street and they get drunk and they're so happy and they're so, you know, desirous of each other. And then that's the moment when you think, uh-oh, something bad's gonna happen, right? Like they're not allowed to be like this in public in the 1980s. There's no AIDS in this movie. There's no gay bashing. The parents don't, you know, go after them for this relationship.
And well, the mother didn't know.
Yeah, sure, the mom didn't know. But there's no outside forces that are explicitly telling them, you cannot be together, this is wrong. But at the same time, they still exist in a world in which this relationship, and there are other layers to this relationship that would make people not in favor of it, right? So they're still aware that this is two men desiring each other in a world in which that's not normalized or quite acceptable as a heterosexual relationship, right? And then they are also aware of that as well. So I think so much of it is too Elio coming to the realization that he is like desiring this other man and kind of dealing with that. And he has a sort of physicality to that of, he's almost like uncomfortable in his own skin, right? He's constantly like squirming and turning and like so unused to that and so uncomfortable with that. And knowing, you know, and then later, of course, we'll come back to that. We can come back to that peach scene when he says, I'm sick, aren't I? Right. And so there's this awareness of that, the particularities of that relationship, and that there's external awareness of that, that everyone else is aware that it is a same-sex relationship. But at the same time, it's removed from some of those stigmas and some of those traumas that are typically associated with this kind of story, which I think is really interesting.
Right. And it's why I take such exception to the description of mm-hmm. it being heady beauty, right? And so it does have a sense of, this is a young man's grappling with his desires, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily a heady endeavor.
Right. It kind of goes back to that sadness idea, right? Because even from the beginning, they're aware that, you know, that there is going to be sorrow involved with this, not just because Oliver has to leave, not just because of the like disparity in their ages or anything like that, but that, you know, this is a relationship that isn't going to be viewed the same way that it is in this, the house that it would be viewed differently in the rest of the world too, right?
Right, but even and you're saying that, the first line of the movie is, here's the usurper. And so what is he usurping? And so what you're saying is that he's coming to usurp, in some ways, his innocence, his maybe ability to think of himself in a more traditional way. Mm-hmm. And so that's been usurped from him by Oliver, right? Because he can't go back once he has said, I'm going to fully embrace all the dimensions of who I'm kind of uncovering myself to be.
That sounds life-changing.
Thanks for joining us.
But you're welcome.
You know what I'm going to have to say to that? I agree to disagree.
Okay.
This is our first in studio agree to disagree.
I love it.
I think we should maybe just like go right into the Pete scene, right?
Sure.
Because there's
yeah, let's
like,
talk about
there's
it.
There's only a few scenes in this movie, because I think you're right that there's a lot of pastoral scenes, and there's a lot in this movie about interiors versus exteriors, and so this is part of the cinematography trilogy, and it really is, because not only is there's scenes where he's inside, and even the configuration of their rooms is so crazy that, you know, he has to pass through the bathroom to get out, or he can go into the other room directly, or he can go through the room to the bathroom to his, and it's just like this crazy tangle that is not like a normal room where you open the door and you go in and then you go out that same door. There's many doors to go in and many doors to go out. So it's very cleverly staged so that the physicality of the location even is showing you the complexity of his life. Just to get to his room is complex. So there's no easy way to get to his room, and it all has to go through Oliver in some way, if you will. He has to deal with Oliver. And so then there's so many scenes where he's wandering inside the house, like you said, just picking up things, trying to do stuff, or he's outside just sitting, watching things happen. And then there's lots of shots of either him looking down from his balcony at things happening below, or him looking up at windows that are closed and he's not sure what's happening behind these shuttered windows. And so it's really well shot in terms of cinematography in trying to portray visually these kind of disconnects that are happening inside this young man. So now I'm above looking down because I'm better than Oliver, and when he sees Oliver, it's, or he looks up at the window and thinks Oliver's in that room, and so then he's looking up at him. Or, yeah. And so it's incredible how it's filmed. So there's not a lot of scenes where things are said to kind of open it up. And so there's really just, I'm going to say there's three scenes. There's the peach scene, there's Marzia when she sees him after Oliver has left, and she comes and talks to him about the book of poems, because she has a little thing before when he gives her the book of poems. And so that kind of is, I'm going to connect that as one scene. He gives her the book of poems, and then she responds to the book of poems. And so that's another dialogue part. And then at the end, when his father talks to him, those are like the three things. If you had to say, can I watch this movie in 10 minutes instead of 2 hours and 11 minutes? You could watch it in 10 minutes by watching those three scenes. And so I think we should talk about those three scenes. And should we talk about the peach first?
Yeah, let's talk about it first.
In the peach scene, he said, am I sick?
Right. Or he said, I am sick, aren't I?
Uh-huh. And then Oliver grabs him and holds him, you know, and all these things. But for me, there's the one part where they're kind of wrestling with each other over the peach. And he says, stop it, you're hurting me. And Oliver says, then stop fighting. And so I think he was saying it on a lot of different levels, like stop fighting like right now, but stop fighting this thing that's inside of you. And so it is kind of a pivotal moment for him, because he has this older, wiser, worldly man say to him, it's okay, stop fighting it. And then I think he just cries and cries and cries. That's his response to that.
And was this the first time that he had been very emotionally vulnerable with Oliver? I think it was. It was also interesting that this happened in the attic. And previously when they'd met, it had been, I think, in Oliver's room or outside. And this attic place was where he'd gone with Marcia. where he'd gone by himself, but Oliver had never been there. And so Oliver was coming into this kind of sacred space for him.
A disgusting sacred place that needs Mafalda to get in there and clean that up.
Mafalda!
Mafalda! Oh, come and clean that air. Air out those mattresses, Mafalda.
Well, because the other thing was, like, the pizza, you know, I was like, it was a little too much for me. I'm just going to say, a little too much.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, so this director is very well known for shooting, because this is his Desire trilogy, and so he's well known for shooting fairly explicit sex scenes. And so this one was actually fairly absent of those, and this was definitely the most explicit scene, I think, of the entire pretty explicit scene of the movie, especially in terms of it being a peach. So it is a lot, that scene.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To consummate it with a peach.
Mm-hmm.
I was
mm-hmm.
thinking about American Pie
mm-hmm.
and just
yeah.
What a disgusting movie that is, you know, and we just go, oh, it's just so base, and then it was kind of the same thing in there, and I was like, really? You know? I don't know. And
I think that was part of him saying, you know, you were saying when he says, you know, stop, you're hurting me, and he says, stop fighting, that was on multiple levels. I think, too, when he says, I'm sick, aren't I? That's on multiple levels, too, right? That he's just like, all of this is just like coming out of me right now, right? This is, you know, like I can't stop myself from doing all of these things, or I'm just like suddenly on this roller coaster of, and the peach, I think, is part of that, you know, like this just like all this desire that he hadn't known he had before. And so I think he's like, oh, this was so gross. You know, he was really ashamed of that, too. You know, I think he felt the baseness of that, too.
Okay, so at the risk of being insensitive, then, I'm going to say, so he has all this desire that's coming out of him, right? And so in that scene, he has this unbridled desire that he has come out of him into the peach, right? So his... like he literally has sexually expresses into the peach. But, and there's other scenes, like he's at the dinner table and his nose just starts bleeding, right? So fluids are coming out of his nose. And then when they're dancing in the streets with the Italian lady to psychedelic furs, nobody, by the way, in 1983 danced to the psychedelic furs. Anyway, then he just starts vomiting. Thinking about the movie, like, what is the message of that? That this desire is so unhealthy that it'll come out in a peach, that it'll come out as blood in his nose, that it'll come out as vomit out of his mouth. I was confused by the message of those images. If it is this heady beauty that's been revealed, why is it causing him to bleed profusely out of his nose and to vomit out of his mouth? That doesn't seem like a healthy expression of your true being. And so
yeah.
I was confused.
No,
I mean,
really
what did those scenes mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand them.
Well, I think it's pretty difficult to express in a healthy way this desire that is so much shame is put upon it by society. And even though there is an explicit trauma in the movie related to it, as we said, there's all these underlying messages that it's wrong and bad. So it's hard for me to imagine somebody being able to express it in a healthy way in such a society.
All right, we're going to agree to disagree. So I'm so glad you're with us today.
This is so exciting that this is our first real in studio agree to disagrees.
Because like if I think about the movie, at what point in the movie, because later Oliver says, you know, when I came and I rubbed your shoulder, that's when I made my first attempt to make an overture towards you, and you didn't take it well, right? That's what he says when they're sitting in the tree or on the balcony or whatever. But then I think it all changes when he's, quote, cataloging the slides with the professor, and they're looking at all those statues of the Roman young boys. And you can just see him sitting on the couch as the professor is academizing these, you know, erotica. And you can just see him, like, the wheels are turning in Oliver's head, like, oh, this is okay, this is okay. And so that's like kind of the turning moment for him, that this is okay to have this relationship with this younger boy. That's what I thought that scene was trying to convey to us, that this isn't taboo. And he's in this house where the father of the boy is saying, this is okay. And even when he comes back and said, I could have had sex with Marzia last night. And they said, why didn't you? It would have been okay. The father's like, it would have been okay. And they're like, yeah, why didn't you? You could have just reached out and touched her. And the mom's like, what you talking about?
Because the mom just never has any idea what's happening.
Right. But they were so open that the father's like, well, you should have just had sex with her. Or here's these statues of these boys. And look, this is how people had sex back then. So it's a pretty safe environment for them and for him. And so even though the greater world may be different, it's one of the things that the Jezebel has said, that we don't have that sense in this movie of impending trauma because of their sexuality, which is why some people like it so much. And so then I'm still questioning then why we have these scenes of him expressing his desire so unhealthily, even though the environment around him is saying, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, in his little cloistered environment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we'll have to have another agree to disagree. Because I see this environment as, I'm sure, much safer than so many. But I think the discussion of his hypothetical heterosexual relationship was more open than the discussion about his homosexual relationship. So I'm not seeing the it's safe, it's okay, it's not shameful message, I think, as strongly as you are. Because that conversation with his father only happened quite a bit later. And a lot of the messages from his parents of encouraging this, like sending them on this vacation together, it was not explicit. They were supporting of it, but it wasn't safe enough that they could be extremely open about it as much as they were with the heterosexual relationship.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here, because we are agreeing to disagree. So if there's a few things, like at the end when the father says, your mother doesn't know, all of us went, what? Because the mother sends him with Oliver on the three-day trip. She absolutely knows.
Right.
And so she not only knows, but she sends him with him. So is that environment safe? Absolutely. And it's openly safe because she sends him. Wait. I know you're dying to talk. And I will stop in a second. And the second thing is that not much happens in this movie, but all of a sudden their friends, this gay couple, show up. Right. And so the dad makes him wear the shirt that they've bought for him, this kind of loud print shirt that he doesn't want to wear, because he calls them Sonny and Cher. The boy does, Elio. And so he mockingly calls them Sonny and Cher. And the father says, don't call them that. And so the father even defends them against the son, who is struggling with his identity around his homosexual desires. And so his father says, don't do that. And so he stands up to him, even though he's not saying, anything about Elio's sexuality. He is openly supporting all forms of sexuality. And so he's expressing it directly to Elio without saying, it's okay if you're gay. He's saying, look, these are people too, and we don't treat them that way. Mm-hmm. And so the message is very clear to Elio. It's very supportive and very safe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is quite a strong point. I'd forgotten about the visit. But for the first point, I think that if it were a safer environment, there would have been no shame in knowing that the mother knew. I think it indicates that there was still some secrecy, the fact that they wanted to still pretend that it wasn't out in the open within the family.
I'm so happy you said that, because who wants the mother not to know?
Elio.
The father.
But doesn't I think the father knows that the mother knows.
The father wants the mother not to know, though, because he is living out his unconsummated friendship, as he says, that I had the chance to do that and I didn't. And then once you don't do it once, you kind of inure yourself to feeling. And so he's basically saying, I settled for your mother. And he doesn't want her to know that he had the same desires that Elio does. So he's pretending that the mother doesn't know, because he doesn't want the mother to know about his own.
Interesting.
And so that's
See,
what the...
Again, we have to agree to disagree.
No!
Because I think that
we
you...
are totally orthogonal
I
here.
I love it. It's great. Because I think that there's a couple of ways that you can read. I do agree that I think that the father is saying that he potentially could have had this friendship with another man and he didn't, but I don't think that necessarily means that the mom is just his beard for the last 30 years because like they're also showing that like it's not necessarily that Elio is just like, oh, I've discovered my identity as a gay man, right? They're kind of, there's like a fluidity in some of the sexuality as well, right? Because he does, even we can talk about how he treats Marcia, but he does clearly actually like desire Marcia as well, right? It's not just like to compensate. He's going to be like, oh, let me go see if I can like be desirous of a woman. He does clearly have desire for Marcia as well, right? So I think that another way you can read the scene where the father is talking about that, where he's saying that this time, you know, not to... in, as you said, inure yourself of feeling because you didn't actually go out and or because this relationship ended or because it never started for the father, I think you can also read that as like that first time that you come into being as like a sexual being or someone or love too, although I think this one was more physical than emotional intimacy. So I think another way you can read that is he says that it's very particular the first time that that happens. And so it can be a man or two women or two men. It's more about that first time that you fall in love with someone or fall into desire of someone. And that when that ends, the way that you deal with that is you can decide to stop feeling or you can feel that pain. And then I don't think that that necessarily has a gender. So I don't think the mom is his beard for 30 years.
Okay, so I'm so glad because we're going to agree to disagree. And so I would say, if you look at the movie, when did you see affection, like physical affection displayed? And mostly you saw it in like desirous situations, when he was desirous of Marzia or when he was desirous of Oliver. You know, you saw it in that realm, but occasionally, I mean, I think the father kissed her when she was smoking a cigarette, but that was about all of the affection you saw between the father and the mother. And then when their friends show up, and I can't remember their names because they were so briefly in and out, they just came for one evening. But when the friends show up, even when he's playing the piano, like the mother's standing on one side of him and the father's on the other side, but those two are standing, the one guy's like cradling the other guy's head. You could see their physical affection for each other. And so you just go, look at the, like again, it's cinematography, look at the visual of that. The mother and father are on either side of their son, and the two men that love each other because they have a friendship, one's holding the other one's head. Very different. The picturing of those two relationships.
See, again, I actually noticed that one of the things that was really nice about the movie that I liked was that there was a lot of physical affection that was also non-sexual. So even like, there's lots of ways that this family is very physically affectionate with each other.
The mother with the son.
Yes, but even
not
like
with the father.
The mother and the father are sunbathing together and she suggests that they go off on the trip together and then he just like squeezes her leg affectionately, right? Or, you know, I just think that there's a lot of just like ways that they are affectionate with each other that are just really nice and don't have to be like PDA with each other, right? Even like Mafalda comes and drops clothes off on Elio's bed and then she just comes up and ruffles his hair. She's like, everybody is just constantly sort of, and they just like touch each other, like just checking in, you know, they're rubbing each other's hair, they're just touching hands. And then, you know, when he's really sad or when it's raining, they're all sort of curled up together while they're reading the book. Everybody is just, you know, his head is in the lap and, you know, they're all like very close, where it's just like an affectionate closeness. And so I really like all the ways that everybody just sort of like reaches out to each other and is just casually really affectionate with each other, right? When he's sad, he puts his head in his dad's lap when they have the conversation, right? I think that there were actually a lot of ways in which people were very affectionate, in physically affectionate in ways that were just about like reaching out to each other.
So we're going to agree to disagree again, because I don't disagree that the older generation was very affectionate with the younger generation. And so they were very affectionate to Oliver as the grad student. Like, they had a great affection for him, which is a mystery because I found him insufferable from the moment he arrived, you know? And, you know, like, who drinks 16 ounces of apricot juice? Who does that? That's like nobody does it. Anyway, he was insufferable. But they just endeared themselves to him, you know, like the fact that he would go later and he would take off. That in the beginning they found it offensive, but then they just took it on as a badge of endearment towards him. And so it was the older generation that kind of embraced it. So when he said Mafalda, you know, rubbed his head, you know, and he laid his head in his dad's lap, or when she's reading the poems, he lays on them and she reads the poems to them. But when he pats her leg, that's not true. That's not like a true sign of affection. So there are people, and so we won't name names, and when they would go to express their affection for the children, they would pat them very hard on the back and say sweet things to them. You know, there's my little honey. But it was very awkward. And it was more of a, I don't know how to physically express my love for you. So I'll do it in a way that I think is what people do. They rub each other, or they pat each other, or they grab your leg when you have a good idea. It's not a true sign of, oh, I'm deeply connected to you. It's like, how can I show that I do love you, but I'm really not that physically interested in being with you. I wish I had that friendship from back when I was 17. That was that gesture.
Agree to disagree, man. Agree to disagree.
Italian Robin Williams
is so
witchy.
What do you think, Physicista?
I'm going to have to take the side of the American Jezebel. I saw
once again, it was nice having you in the studio.
Orthogonality for the win here. Forget interiority and exteriority. It's the orthogonal team that wins.
I agree. I did notice physical affection between the mother and father and between many different relationships in the movie.
Should we move to other key scenes?
Yes, we should. AKA Oliver dancing on the dance floor again to that same song. Da, da, da. Yeah. Oh, I loved. I think my favorite part about Oliver was what a terrible dancer he was.
I thought that was one of his shining moments because I felt like that was when he was the most loose. Otherwise, I found his acting a little wooden. But In the dancing, yes, it was very dorky, but I thought that he embraced the dorkiness.
Most endearing was all the dancing. Elia was a much better dancer than Oliver, and that it was like, yeah, he had, I mean, just generally, my boyfriend and my son, Timothée Chalamet, his performance, there was a lot of great physicality in his, I think. Mm-hmm. His dancing, just his, like, general, complete, like, awkwardness in his own, like, tiny little 90-pound body.
Yeah, the American Jezebel commented that he was like a string bean, which I... Yeah. I thought was well worded.
Okay, mm-hmm. Should we look at other scenes? But then I actually have some questions about this movie as well.
Okay.
So would you we like to look at the other two scenes in it?
Yeah. What were the other two scenes that we were going to look at? Marcia.
Marcia and the Book
and then
of Poems.
We've talked a little bit already about the dad and his conversation
and
with the son.
And then his dad's conversation at the end.
Because we have kind of some different readings of that conversation.
Yeah. But those are like the two big.
Okay. Let's
other
talk about
scenes.
The Marcia scene then.
Okay. So the Marcia scene, when he gives her the Book of Poems, he said, do you like to read? And she said, no, I don't trust people who read. They're hiding something. Which is spot on, Marcia. She nailed it, right?
Marcia was the wisdom of this movie.
She was unbelievable because then when she goes back to him and says, am I your girl? And he's like, no, I don't think so. And then she just leaves. And we all knew it. You said, you know, people love this movie because there's no trauma. We knew trauma was coming Marzia's way. We just knew it. She knew it even. You're not going to hurt me, are you?
No, she said, I know you're going to hurt me.
Yes. And so she knew it was coming, Marzia. And we knew it was coming. And so then after Oliver leaves him, he comes back in the car and the mom goes into the bar to have a couple drinks while he sits in the car and waits.
I love the mom. The mom is living her best life with her apparently non-interested in her husband.
Okay, so if she's so in love with her husband, why is she going to the bar to drink with the local boys? She's looking for a man who loves her.
She is not.
You have just reiterated my point. Come over here, physicist. You are on the wrong side.
She's just living her best life. Picking those apricots, bossing around to the house guests, listening to her boring Italian friends yell about politics, and just being completely uninterested.
So Marzia comes over to the car to be with him, and she said, "I just wanted to let you know I read your book of poems." And then she said, "I'm not angry with you. I'm not mad at you. I've realized how sad you are." And so she even says how sad this movie is. So in defense of my reading of the sadness, they said it in the movie. And I think, she nails it. And why she's not mad at him, because she knows. And she even then says, friends for life. And why does she say friends for life? Because she knows that he's never going to love her in the way he did those two times. Because he's now been with Oliver. And so he's realizing something about himself that excludes her, and she sees it in him even if he doesn't. So a really critical scene for the movie to have her kind of name it without naming it, right? So she crushed it. Marzia did.
Yeah, I love Marzia, and she also had a great sense of style.
Great outfits.
Oh, great outfits. Yeah. I hope that they are making a sequel, and I hope the sequel is Marzia Goes to Paris.
We didn't want to go Clermont-Ferrand.
Yes. Marzia moves to Clermont-Ferrand and meets a nice lady, and that's the sequel.
Okay. And then the last scene was the father.
Well, we've already kind of talked about the scene, and I do think that he's laying out, like, the thesis of the movie, right? And, like, all this whole movie where nothing really happens except that they're slowly acknowledging that they're attracted to each other and then declaring that, right? And then he's saying, you know, don't close yourself off to the sadness and the sorrow that you feel, because then that will negate the joy that you felt, right? Which I think, again, kind of goes back to our talking about even like the visuals and the cinematography of the movie, that there's this heaviness and even this sorrow to it at the same time that there is, like, it's very lush and beautiful, you know, that there is this balance between those two things. And again, I think that's what, you know, the credits are too, when he's crying into the fire, is that there is the balance between those two things. So I think, you know, that's what the father is saying, and that's what the movie is trying to say and kind of explicitly making that clear. This is what we're saying, right? And that there is a lot of sadness to that relationship because of some of its particularities too.
I agree. Yeah. I'm not sure I have any more to say on that.
Yeah, that's why you're on that side of the table, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right. And he says, oh, I guess maybe that might be, you know, he says, you know, to feel nothing in order to feel as not to feel anything, what a waste. So he's saying, if you cut yourself off, if you want to feel nothing now, you won't feel anything, which I think goes back to our larger conversation about that being kind of either you read it as I cut myself off from feeling because I was feeling things for a man, or I cut myself off from feeling because I fell in love, then that ended and it was so painful that I decided I didn't want to feel anything, and then it was hard to reopen that up to myself to someone else again.
And he couldn't. That's the part you're
unwilling
to admit. It just
was different.
Confirmed my argument.
No, I did
give it
not
up. Give
I did
it up.
Not
give into it. Don't fight it.
No.
Don't fight it.
It's just
as
different
Oliver would say,
because
don't
it's
fight
harder
it.
To open up those scars and wounds once they're there than the first time.
Italian Robin
when
Williams
you fall
did
off
not
your bike,
say any of that.
When you fall off your bike and get a giant scrape, it hurts a lot. You don't want to re-scrape yourself in that same way. You don't get back on the bike.
You go swimming in a swamp to clean it all up.
The hygiene of this movie is terrible. Everyone needed to just take a bath in Purell after this movie.
I did. I needed to after he kissed him after he vomited. I was like, I just can't get on board with that. I'm sorry. Call me a prude, but.
All right. Should we talk about some of the our favorite shots?
Well,
of the
no,
movie,
I actually have a serious
lines.
Question.
Oh yes, you have questions.
Yes.
Okay.
So I have a serious question. Why Jewish?
I do think that is a really good question. Yes. Because it was interesting, you know, they're explicitly like straddling all these different identities too. Because we didn't talk about language in the movie either, right?
Right?
They slip in and out of English and German and French and Italian, right? It like constantly switches. It's really interesting. So they're almost like code switching in their, you know, and even in their family, they're like speaking, you know, the mom and the son will speak French and then they'll speak Italian. And then the mom is reading in German to the family. So they're really like straddling all these really interesting identities too. And going back to this, a little bit this idea, because he says he doesn't wear his Star of David, which Armie Hammer actually is like partially Jewish, even though he looks extremely Aryan.
1%.
I think it's
the
like
same
what,
that I'm
he
Swedish.
Might, it might be his like maternal grandmother or something though, which means he's technically very Jewish. I think he's technically a member of the tribe, just never forget that name, Armie Hammer. But you know,
did you say then, Arnhem Hammer?
It's actually Armand is his name. but yeah, he says Elio says his mom says we are Jews of discretion. Yes, which I think might link a little bit back to some of the gay themes of this movie too, that they might be also, you know, and kind of going back to what the physicista was saying about
might
this
go back to the father being heterosexual by discretion.
I'm bringing it back around to what the physicista's point about the balance between it being a very accepting environment but not explicitly accept that they're still going to say, oh, this is a friendship, wouldn't it be nice if you two have like a friend's vacation, or, you know, that they're, oh, we're Jewish, you know, we have a clearly Jewish name, we, you know, we are going to celebrate Hanukkah, but we're Jews of discretion, that we are this thing and we're not going to be ashamed of that thing, but we're also not going to advertise that thing.
I agree, and I think that this the presence of three different languages, Jewish and American, and straddling these different identities emphasizes the liminality of this movie. They cannot be easily categorized. Similarly, as Elio is exploring his sexual orientation, his desire, and as he's coming of age and entering this liminal space, it's in many facets.
Yeah, right? Like, who does he want to become? Mm-hmm. Right? And he, like, starts to wear the Jewish star because Armie Hammer wears a Jewish star, right? So he's like, ooh, do I want to really advertise this or no? Like, how do I want to interact with my identity as a Jewish person?
You think that's what he was asking?
I think that the star wearing it is more an expression of his relationship with Oliver, right? And the kind of the power dynamics that are at work there.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why I take exception to the life-changing, because so much of it was he was creating himself to be what he thought would be attractive to Oliver. So he starts wearing his star again. And then even at the end, you know, they see the people dancing to Psychedelic Furs, Love My Way, right? And then he said, oh, Richard Butler, oh, he's a god, and blah, blah, blah. And she said, have you seen him in concert? And she talked, right? And he's sitting on the side, and he hears him. And when he hears him say Richard Butler is a god, he vomits. And then when we see him at Hanukkah, he's dressed like Richard Butler.
Oh, is that what Richard Butler looked like?
It kind of did, like a young Richard Butler, that kind of look, right? As he got older, he got a little different looking, but almost like a young Psychedelic Furs new wave look. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so he's tried to become who he heard him say was a god or whatever he said, right? And so he's just modeling himself after what he thinks he's going to desire. And so I don't think it's him actually becoming who he wants to be. It's him becoming who he thinks Oliver is attracted to, which is all good because he's, you know, 17 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I take up exception to the description of the movie, because it was just like something that he was going through as a young person.
Right. I think it is like a natural step sometimes for people to say, like, okay, like, how am I going to make, you know, especially if you're that age, like, I desperately want somebody to desire me. So I'm going to model myself in some way that then somebody else will find that attractive. And it is like one of those just like, yeah, a stepping stone in your development as a person to say like, okay, I need to be this person that somebody else will like me and validate me. Yeah, that those are expressions of that. And I think that's really clear in the movie that you really feel like he is that age, you know?
Yes.
You really feel that he is that teenager, that he's in that space. It's like, it's, and it's almost uncomfortable in that way because of the power dynamics in that relationship and the like, especially because Armie Hammer does not look like the age he's supposed to be in the movie. He looks like he is a man, and Timothée Chalamet looks like a boy. And so I think that makes it even more explicit and even more sometimes uncomfortable to see that play out too.
Okay, and then I have one more serious question. Okay, so one of the litmus tests of talking nonsense is, in the moment when it mattered most, did he show a lack of character or an abundance of character? And so there it is, the end, it's snowing, snow's coming down on our Italian villa, and we've come for Hanukkah, and it must be the last night of Hanukkah because all the candles are lit, and come in listening to my headphones of the Psychedelic Furs, I'm sure is what he was listening to, dressed like Richard Butler. He comes in, and the phone rings, and he answers the phone, which is an interesting, another thing I didn't think, how often they don't recognize each other's voices. Like, he doesn't recognize his mom's, he doesn't recognize Marzia's, you know, they, when they call, they don't recognize each other's voices, which was a curious part of the movie, but that's not my question. Then he says, if something I have to tell you, no, you're getting married, is the first thing that comes out of his mouth. And he said, yes, right? So he's obviously had this relationship with, because it's only 6 months later that he's getting married. So he's had this off and on, he says, relationship with this woman. And then there's Elio on the phone, this young kid who starts going, Elio, 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 right? Until Oliver then calls him Oliver. And so I just think, okay, how is this for his wife, his fiance? He's on the phone saying the critical thing to the depth of their relationship, which is they will call each other by their name, the other's name. And this kid is saying, you know, basically, do you still love me? Do you still, am I primary in your life? And on the other end of the phone, he has to choose. Hopefully his fiance is sitting next to him as he says. Because then he does. He says, Oliver, Oliver, Oliver. In the moment when it mattered most, he showed a complete lack of character. Because either he tells the woman, I'm in love with Elio and I'm going to go be with him, or he tells Elio, I'm actually in love with this woman, and I will call her by my name, not you. He can't have it both ways. He's the same as the boss and Set It Up. He wants to have the affair with his former wife and marry his new fiance. It's the same exact situation. And Oliver showed a complete lack of character.
What do you think?
If I were the wife, I would not be very happy. So, yeah. And so you're asking this question of Oliver and not Elio?
Well, Elio, we can maybe excuse because he's young. And we can maybe pass it off as infatuation. And he just desperately wants to hear that he loves him. But Oliver has obviously moved on because he's back there going to get married.
He's trying to move on.
Well, he's not dressing like Richard Butler. He's not putting Elio's swim trunks on his head and laying in bed. I'm thinking he, like, if you're going to stand by your argument, has moved on and is marrying the wife who won't be a beard to him, but will be actually a love.
I'm making that argument about the parents. It's not a broad thing that if you ever have an affair with a man, you will just then fall in love with a woman.
No, I'm
not
saying
making it broader.
He's being asked
thing.
To choose,
no,
right?
No, I know.
Can you love a man and then later love a woman as deeply as you love that man? That's the question that was being asked in that moment. And his answer was
Oliver's or the father's?
Oliver's.
Oliver's.
His answer was, I love you, Elio.
Right, right. But I think
she will be a beard for the rest of my life.
But that does not mean that that's true for the father.
That's exactly what the father said, and that's why it's in the movie.
No.
Why else would that scene be there?
Things are more fluid than that.
Things are more fluid.
Absolutely.
Stop.
Yeah. Stop.
You
absolutely
can only use that defense once per podcast, and you've already used it.
Oh, no, I think there's a lot more fluidity in this.
Exactly.
Ah, oh, yes. I don't know. I don't agree with you to the extent that this is him making a choice between those two people. I think that it is. I think that he should not have echoed that back to him. But I don't think that it is to the extent of him saying, this other woman is my beard for the rest of my life. Because I think that I think that you can also read it as just that same longing that he can still love Aelio. Even if we have no idea what his relationship with the woman is like, mm-hmm. right? Well, you know, it's on, off and on, and now they're getting married, but that you can't love two people or love two people differently.
Okay, but in that moment, what is Aelio asking him? He's not saying, did you love me when you were with me? And he's saying, I mean, even the act itself, right? That call me by your name. Mm-hmm. You know, I love you as much as I love my own self. Your importance is as important as my very self, right? Which you would think that, you know, to give your life for others is like the most, you know, noble gesture. Like we always say, wow, that's a true hero. They gave their lives for others. And so that's what they're saying in that moment. Call me by your name. I love you as much as I love myself. I can't love more, right? And I don't mean it narcissistically. You know, I mean, like, if I cease to exist, that's how much you not being here would be. It would be like the end of me. I'm going to call you me, right? It's that critical moment for childhood development when a child says, I, when they recognize their individualness, that they're not their parents anymore, right? Mm-hmm. That we recognize this state of development in children because it's so profound when they recognize their I-ness. And to call another person your I, you can't, right? It's that incredible thing about I, that there's only one I, you. And in that moment, they're saying, you're my I. I'm going to call you I, is basically what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm going to call you I because that's how profound our relationship is. And then he calls him and he asks him in front of his fiance to say, call me your I. Mm. And he does. Mm. And so it's just not a matter of can you love this person and then situations change and then you love this person. You know, and so I'm jokingly saying it's his beard, right? But in the fact that he would say, you're my I, it's clear that he's maybe not saying that she's his eye. And that's a very different statement than saying, I loved you during that summer. And I love her now, and I'll be with her for 35 years. And maybe during that time, I'll love somebody else, right? And it may be a friendship that's not consummated, right? But I will love somebody else deeply, but maybe not as deeply as I love her. But in that moment, he does say, you are my eye. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say, okay, then go be with your eye. You showed a lack of character. Mm-hmm. And we can explain it through forces that are, you know, encouraging him to be a certain way in the world. And there's mm-hmm. pressures for him to be that way.
Right.
Which he explicitly says in the phone call.
Right. But mm-hmm. still, it's a lack of character.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I think Oliver, he's tall, he's handsome, conventionally.
Not our type.
Don't call us, Army.
He's
charismatic. From the moment he arrives in Italy, everybody loves him. So he's very used to being accepted, not only accepted, but praised all the time. And he knows that he would be giving that up if he pursued his relationship with Aelio. So maybe it's not so much a decision about love, but a decision about being accepted by society. And he makes his choice.
He did.
Yeah, I think that, yes, I think that is a really interesting reading of that. Yeah, absolutely. Hmm. He is the, who's the dude and set it up?
John, he has some...
His real name is like Glenn or something. Yeah, he's the Glenn of this movie.
Yeah, he is.
And Aelio is the Harper of this movie.
He's no Harper. He's no Harper.
He is far less charming than Harper.
She did not violate that popcorn.
No. She was also an adult and he's a teenager in all the ways that teenagers are frustrating.
But I think given that Elio was younger and that he does not have the same, he's not received by society in the same way as Oliver is, I could see this being a life-changing event for him, in that he can see a different trajectory for his life because of this relationship, because he's younger and less is decided for him, whereas it's very different in Oliver's case.
That's correct, but in that vein, you know, all kinds of things happen for Elio that are change his life. I mean, the fact that he gets to go spend his summers in Italy, that makes him very different than probably his peers in 1983. As somebody who was alive in 1983, there were not a lot of my peers that were spending their summer in an Italian village, transposing classical music and speaking three languages. In fact, none of my peers were doing that, right? So he was distinctly different anyway, and those things shaped his life. And so this would just be another thing that does shape his life, right? And obviously that's what the movie's about, this event that shaped his life. But we could pick out others. And so I'm not sure that the father saying, you know, it seemed to be, it was the defining moment for the father, his unrequited or unconsummated relation friendship. It seemed that all these years later, the father was still grieving that. And so it seemed to be for the father that was that event. And so maybe for Elio, this will be that event, but maybe not. There may be other events that are more profound in his life than this one.
Only the sequel can tell us.
The sequel is going to be about Marzia.
Yeah, it's going to be Marzia moves to Cremonaland and finds a nice lady. Call us, Luca Guadagnino.
Yeah.
And I think that Elio showed a complete lack of character when it mattered most with Marzia, when she asks, am I your girl? And he's, what? With his towel around his shoulders, and he just doesn't know how to handle it.
No, in the immortal words of the anarcho-syndicalist, he was not kind.
No, he used her.
Yeah, he did, and she was very kind to him in the end. Yeah, which brings us to favorite lines, because obviously I've already kind of maybe tipped my hand on what my favorite line is.
Yeah, what was your favorite line of the movie?
Well, my favorite line was Marzia. Friends for life. Because it packed so much, you know, that she knew, and she didn't have to say, I know. And she acknowledged his sadness, and then she accepted him, even though he had harmed her. And so in that one little sentence, she just packs so much in. And so it was my favorite line of the movie, because she really did nail it with just like seven words.
My favorite line was, Richard Butler, fantastico.
Oh, there we go.
Let's bring back the nonsense. This has been a very serious episode.
I know, I didn't get pitched.
Because it's just dorky Armie Hammer dancing terribly and loving like a new wave 80s band.
I was going to pitch a non-monetized sport, and then I was thinking cornhole may not be politically correct for this movie. Anyway. What was your favorite line?
I'm going to have to say two, because one that's more nonsense, one that's less nonsense.
Oh, two.
Yes, oh. I can't decide. One of them is, what? When Elio responds to going on this trip to the archaeological dig. And it was just, I don't think we'd heard anything like that from him before. It was interestingly placed. My other favorite line was, is it better to speak or to die? Which is much less nonsense. And I think sums up the choice of the movie of whether to hold yourself back or whether to die in some way. or whether to allow yourself to feel and have the courage to ask a question.
It could be like the defining line of the movie, because it's both the son, the father, all of them.
Right.
Even even Oliver at the end of the phone. Is it better to speak or die?
Right, and it was the story within the story, so it's extra important.
Yeah, very nice. Nicely done, physicista.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
Come over to the right side of the table.
No, stay on this side of the table.
We will remain orthogonal.
All right.
Did you see
and
how
then...
it just flowed out so naturally?
Yes.
We will remain orthogonal.
It's because she's been prompted.
I bet Alyona's parents say it like once a day.
They're very educated.
But
Oliver
they'll say it in
give
French.
Us the etymology of it. Well, it's from the Babylonian.
That was some male answer syndrome right there. Woof. Ah, that did not endear Oliver to me, at least. Mm-hmm. Nope. I love it when men explain things to me.
Yes, correct us. Correct us at our...
Especially if they get, what did he say? I'm going to get etymological on you for a second or something like that. In his little polo. I'm so mad.
But they were period tennis shoes. Those Converse high tops, those were in.
That might have been my favorite thing about Oliver, was his tennis shoes and his dorky dancing.
Yeah.
Those were the times when he was not Oliver.
Insufferable.
Insufferable, yes.
I think that would be the word for Oliver.
And then since this is our cinematography, we're rounding out our cinematography mm-hmm. trilogy, this was a beautifully shot movie.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, beautiful movie. And I was trying to think, you know, there's a lot of like pastoral shots that are really beautiful, you know, and we just hold on that shot of them biking away off into the distance and we just listen to the sounds when they're hiking up and they're just actually like joyful and happy, you know, they're up in like the beautiful, I mean, it's just like the Italian countryside is a beautiful part of this movie. And then I also really love the shot when they're in the little hotel together, because there's lots of ones where they're on little balconies and things like that, but they're kind of like hemmed in by the corners of the window in a way that they aren't when they're on the balconies of the house, and like the light is behind them and they're kind of boxed in by that window, and it's just the shadow of the two of them, and kind of like their, you can see how much their physicality informs like their characters, and then the way that there's this light coming in behind them but they're also like boxed in by these things, the light in that scene, it's like, that's my favorite time of day, is that like, you know, pre-dark when all the light is blue and that blue light is coming in on them, and it is kind of sad but beautiful, and I think that that's one of my favorite shots of the movie.
One of my favorite shots was when they had just gotten off their bikes and they were in some small town and they were looking at the monument and they're starting to have I think one of their first serious conversations. They're talking. One of them says, like, are you talking about what I think you're talking about? Like, I would never have the courage to ask that. And as they're having this conversation, they start on the same side of the monument, and then they walk around opposite sides. And then as they kind of come to the conclusion that they are both on the same page, they rejoin on the other side of the monument. Some hidden meanings there, I think.
Even more, it was a great scene.
Uh-huh.
Because the soldier is throwing rocks off the top of the mountains at the dragon down below.
Right.
Which is a crazy monument. And so, what is the symbolism of the movie?
And the monument itself is phallic as well. So.
Yeah. And also really rough. It's mm-hmm. it's just rough stone.
Right.
And so it's not a polished monument.
Right.
There's a lot, that was a really nice scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going to go for like a tiny one, because there was a few. There was like, you know, I'll throw out two because you threw out two lines. There was one where he's sitting in like in the moonlight, and I can't remember what was happening. Like he was waiting for Oliver to come home or something, and he's just kind of sitting out in the orchard. Maybe this is when he was smoking more and eating less apricots, because the physicista has like created a constant that there's a direct ratio,
an inverse relationship
inverse proportional with some kind of constant Is there an apricot cigarette constant? The physicista constant?
There must be. I'll run the numbers.
Yeah, please, because we want to know what that constant is.
Take it back to the lab and test this.
Yeah, absolutely. I will.
Shoot some lasers at the apricots and cigarettes.
Yeah, bring some stupid to that lab.
Yeah, really make them really, really cold.
And fast. Yes.
And stupid. The trilogy. But there was that scene, which was really lovely. But early in the movie, they were just like showing pictures, and there's one picture where it's like from a top of a building looking down on like one of the buttresses or something, and then there's iron bars that come out from the building that tie into the buttress, and they're perpendicular to each other. They're not orthogonal, they're perpendicular. And so I liked it because, again, it's this thing that like maybe we think of worlds being this way, and it's early in the movie, so is this how the world exists? Is it exists that there's the straight line and then there's the perpendicular line? Or are they less?
Are they more fluid?
There was none of that.
They've got to be.
Like, how would you gather anything fluid from this movie? Like 16 ounces of apricot juice, maybe? And so it was just like little things like that. Like, why would they show that picture? And so there was like lots of little tiny visual touches to it. And so I think we could pick out lots and lots.
Yeah. And then let's talk about one more thing when it comes to this movie. This has been quite a discussion of it. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about our star by far. I think the physicista is going to give us her star by far.
Okay.
My star by far was the professor, the father. I enjoyed his little leap hop up to the table. That was one of his first appearances. He also had a very charming cackle that stuck out to me at a few different points, and he just suddenly randomly dug up all these incredible statues that they just happened to be there. And then, as we've talked about, this conversation at the end that was pivotal in the movie. I think the father played an enormous role in Elio's ability to be emotionally vulnerable and his ability to find a safer space than the rest of society in this house. I thought it was very emotionally intelligent advice to lean into your feelings and to not try to numb yourself. So I appreciated it.
Do you want me to choose my star by far?
I think so, America Jezebel. Get it.
Well, you know who my star by far is going to be.
The gardener.
Yes. Well, yes. I'll now it's my turn to pick two. My turn to pick two. So I'll have a nonsense one and a serious one. But my nonsense one is the old man gardener who's also like the fisherman who also is just like living his best life too. There's a couple people in this movie who are living their best lives. And the gardener is one of them. Yes.
You want to see the movie from his perspective?
I do. You know, just an old Italian fisherman gardener who's just like, who are these crazy Americans coming in here? They don't know. What are they up to? I don't know. I'm just going to go. I'm sure he has a really nice. He's the one that owns all those cows that we keep hearing but never see. Always hear the cows, but we never see a single cow. What was happening with the cows? That's my serious question about the movie. Where are the cows? But my serious star by far is Marcia.
The cows are fluid, aren't they?
Yes, they are fluid cows. No, my serious one is Marcia. Marcia is my star by far. She's a super cutie, which is one of our sometimes we choose star by fars for being super cutie pies. She's a super cutie pie with a great sense of style. And like the father, she is really, you know, emotionally intuitive and understanding. And like you've talked about before with some of your favorite line, I think it really demonstrates her also emotional maturity in a way that Elio does not have in the movie. And that she understands him. And, you know, she is hurt and she feels sorrow and she takes that sorrow and does not let it curdle into something and doesn't ignore it either. So she also processes that as well. So
oh, nice.
Marcia is
my star by far. She felt
something
so that she can feel anything.
She can, yes.
Very
it could
nice.
Be a man or, in the sequel, a woman.
Okay, I've used up my two, so I can't do two. So I'm just going to go pure nonsense. The Citroën DS. The car that is driven by their friends. It is the great, if I could pitch it to the narco-syndicalist, I would pitch that car. It is like the most beautiful car ever made. And I think it's fitting for the movie because before it was made, Citroën had made this Traction, it was called, and it looked like a 30s Ford. You know, so if you picture like a 1930 or 1940s Ford, like a 1940, those hot rod cars where they have the big grill and the headlights that pop up, open fenders, etc. It had that look to it. Gangsters, the French gangsters drove them, right? They were those cars. And they had made them for like 30-something years, and then they decided they were going to redesign. And so they went from being this very solid, traditional, widely accepted car to then designing the DS, which means goddess, right? Like, but it's just initials, DS. Mm. And so it's a kind of a play that they designed the goddess after the gangster car. And the goddess was so futuristic. I forgot all the features of it. It's just incredible, right? Pneumatic suspension, so when you turn it on, it rises up off of the ground. It has a pneumatic brake, so the brake looks like a gigantic mushroom that sticks out of the floorboard. And you push, and when you push on it, you're just pushing fluid into the brake cylinders. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of this spongy little thing that you put your foot on, and people have a hard time driving it. The gears are hydraulic as well, and so it's a crazy gear shifting thing.
Sounds very fluid.
It's very fluid. It is, yes. It is probably the most fluid thing in the movie. It has headlights that turn with the steering wheel. So when you turn, the headlights go so it looks where you're looking. They could not have picked a more perfect car for the movie.
They must have had a car consultant for this.
I want that job. I want to be car consultant on every movie. Because if you could just name a car that encapsulates that movie, that is the car. It is who it is. And it's tender. It needs to be nurtured. It's hard to care for. It's, you know, it has all these qualities about it that are forward-looking, but also are very comforting to the people that drive in it. And so it's like the father of the movie, comforting in times of great distress, not afraid to feel things so they can feel everything, but pushing the boundaries of what's accepted. And there was no fluidity. It went from one thing to another. No. It skipped liminalness. Citroën did. So the car is my star by far. All right. Do we have any more sponsors?
We do, yes. So, just like there were too many mouth sounds when people were eating fruits in this movie, we're gonna bring some ASMR back into the podcast.
I literally almost had to leave that scene for that reason when he was slurping on that peach. Oh, wait, don't open it until I stop talking. Okay, so she's gonna.
So the physicista is going to test our sponsor for today,
which is Tony's Choco Lonely. I'm going to open the package.
That was great ASMR, though. The sound of the paper, the sound of the foil, the snap of the chocolate. So what do you think of Tony's Chocolonely? This is the milk chocolate, sea salt, and caramel.
That we are often sponsored by.
Creamy, rich, and delicious. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan.
And Greasy Ripping, can you tell us why we like Tony's in particular, aside from its delicious flavor?
We love Tony's because Tony is trying to create slave-free chocolate, not just for himself, but for the whole of the chocolate industry. And so I was surprised to learn that there were still slaves producing chocolate. And now I eat almost exclusively Tony's Chocolonely because I am committed, as is Tony, to slave-free chocolate worldwide.
So thank you, Tony, for being another future sponsor of the podcast. Your chocolate is delicious, and we wholeheartedly support what you're up to in the world.
Absolutely.
We love it.
Yep.
All right, so
Sustainable Butter, we love you too.
We do, Sustainable Butter.
Our only real sponsor.
Our real sponsor. We know you don't listen, but thank you for being our only real sponsor. So let's wrap this up.
Digestibly delicious, nutritionally nutty, something we can never remember.
Never remember our ad copy for Sustain
a problem
Butter.
With sponsors.
We don't have any ad copy for Tony's besides our continuous ASMR of eating the chocolate. So let's wrap up this movie by talking about what we watched before and then giving our ratings.
Okay.
So what did you watch before, and how would you rate this movie?
All right. Yeah. Thank you. I watched The Clapper before this. Ed Helms, help me out, Amanda Siegfried.
Siegfried,
thank you. And Tracy Morgan. Alan Thicke in his last performance, I believe. And so there was a little tribute at the end. But the story is about our guy, the Clapper, who is a professional clapper. And he has lost his love of his life and gone out to L.A. to follow his dream of being on TV, even if it just means sitting in the audience. Falls in love with the gas station attendant. And they just have this lovely little relationship that falls apart when he becomes somewhat famous as the Clapper. And his whole thing is just to find her and to be with her, because they, in their quirkiness, love each other. And it's just a sweet, sweet little movie about not doing what, because the late show people want him to be this big phenomenon. He doesn't want that. He just wants to be with her. So he doesn't want what everybody thinks he wants, which is fame and attention and everything. He just wants to make a living and be with the person he loves. And except for like the last 5 minutes of the movie, it's a very, very sweet movie. So that influenced mine, because I thought he was living his life. He was dealing with what it means to have lost what he thought he was, then transitioning into being who he was, and the struggles of that space, and all the things that come to try to knock you out of that space, the pressures from the outside world. And he did not fall for them and stay true to the goal, which was her. And so that's a sweet love story. I did not find this movie a sweet love story. I did not understand why they liked each other, what they had in common other than physical desire. I found him insufferable, and the boy was just a teenage boy, and you know, I was like, okay, he's a teenage boy, he should be with a teenage kid so they can work out their things together. So I was not enamored with the relationship. And so I found this movie really not very enjoyable. The cinematography made it watchable, but and then three scenes were of interest. And other than that, the movie was unpleasant to me. So I say 161. I gave it 161. KBs. We don't say the name of them. We just say KB. What have you watched before?
Roma, which happened to be on Obama's list of favorite movies of 2018. And I think that Roma could fall well within the cinematography genre, and as well as the liminal space. So I'd recommend a review of it. I'd love to hear what you two think. But it's about a domestic worker, an indigenous domestic worker in Mexico City in the 1970s. And there's interesting similarities to Call Me By Your Name, in that it's not extremely plot-driven, but it's still very engaging. It's a lot of showing this young woman's day-to-day life. She has sex and gets pregnant, and then the father abandons her, and she delivers a stillborn. There's a fire and nothing comes of it. There's in kind of the final scene is her. She can't swim, but she swims into the water to save the two of the children of the family that she works for. And then one of the last lines is the children praising her for saving them, and then the very next thing they say is, "Can you get us some ice cream?" So it's showing the unfairness in different ways of her life, that she feels such guilt about this child, and that she didn't really want the child, and did she make it be a stillborn? And yeah, I thought it was a perspective that is important to see. And so I thought it was an interesting contrast to this movie because she really didn't have a safe place. And so it showed the trauma of her day-to-day life, living in this world that wasn't built for her and is not kind to her. And so in watching Call Me By Your Name, it was refreshing. It was more enjoyable, I would say, to watch a movie where these marginalized identities do not have as much trauma imposed on them. So it was an interesting contrast. I give Call Me By Your Name 9,000 KBs. Yes, I was engaged in the movie, and I found the cinematography that it the symbolism very well supported the relationships and the hidden meanings.
All right, so I'll wrap it up. So what I watched before, I think the last movie that I watched was Rumblefish, our previous episode, which is a very visually interesting movie that's not really we found it that it said some things, but it's much more exclusively a playground visually than it is, you know, narratively or thematically. So it was, I think this movie, Call Me By Your Name, had a lot more that it was saying and that it was saying through, or it was trying to do those things. And I had seen it before. I had seen Call Me By Your Name before, and I think I actually liked it more the first time I saw it. This is not really a movie that I want to come back to and watch a lot, because I think especially I found Armie Hammer more insufferable than I did the previous time. I did not really like either of the main characters. Like, I don't really want to spend time with them, but I don't think that that's necessarily the mark of a good movie. Do you want to hang out with the characters? To All the Boys I Loved Before, I would 100% hang out with them, and I love them also as characters. These people I didn't like so much, but I did think in a lot of ways it was a beautiful movie. It's a movie that I think it's interesting. We didn't come around to the question of who is this movie for, but I think that there's a lot of people that this movie could appeal to more than it even appealed to me. And I've read some critics who come from a very different place, and so I think they appreciated the movie for a lot of the things that we've talked about when it comes to it. So I don't even know if this is supposed to be a love story either. I think it's maybe supposed to be, but I don't love it as a love story at all, because I don't really like the people, and I don't think that they have like a relationship that I would want to emulate or that I find terribly interesting. But I think it is a beautiful movie, and I think that there's a lot to be said about this, a movie about a boy who gets to fall in love with a man, and that it does not involve trauma around that, besides the trauma of losing someone that you love. So I gave this 17,645 kissing booths. Yes. So I don't love this movie, love this movie, but I think this was a very good film.
This is our largest disagreement ever.
It is. It's really exciting. The Physicista got to be here for our biggest spread our biggest disagreements about a movie. It's super fun. We've really agreed on most movies before, so this is really fun.
Yeah, it's quite a range.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah, no, I fully expected us to agree on almost every movie throughout our careers.
Nope, we got to have movies that we disagree on. It's great.
So maybe movies I haven't seen before.
We've had other movies that we've disagreed on or two that we've had a little bit, not in the podcast, but we've gone and seen some movies that you liked more than I did. So yeah, I think that it's good to have some back and forth here.
The Front Runner.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we had some disagreement on The Front Runner, if anyone wants to go see
very,
that.
Very, very deep disagreement. Okay, but we're not watching that next.
No, we are not. We're transitioning into a new trilogy.
Ooh.
Yeah, this was really a fairly no-nonsense episode, I gotta say. We had some mostly discussion here. There's not a lot of nonsense in here. So I think that, you know, we've actually had some interesting flow between our movies. We had a palate cleanser. We had one that was just very visual. We've had this one, which is our big disagreement movie. And it was very also a no-nonsense movie, too. You know, there's not a lot of humor in this movie. This is not a funny movie. And so I think it's nice that we're going to transition to what may be a little bit more humorous movie next week. In 2 weeks. So we are moving into our new trilogy. Should we tell them what the trilogy is, or should we?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So we're starting a new trilogy. We have researched it, and you can, in fact, rent this movie to watch.
On the website that we don't name.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure you could find it in a couple other places, too. But in 2 weeks, please join us in watching But I'm a Cheerleader.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, what is that movie about?
Yes, I could basically say that because I watched it in high school. So I do not really remember what happens in this movie at all.
It's going to be basically new. Literally, you watched it in high school.
I was in my high school.
Yeah, they showed it at school.
Which may not shock you, but my perspective is maybe a little bit on Call Me By Your Name, but I was in the Gay Straight Alliance in high school. And we watched this. The club showed this film, But I'm a Cheerleader.
So. And it may not shock you that the Gay Straight Alliance did not exist when I was in high school.
Yes.
In a high school. In,
maybe a suburban. Nearby the years of 1983.
Very close to the years. So... If it did exist, they would have been holding a school dance with only one song. Love my word. I can't go as deep as he does.
So in 2 weeks, please join us for But I'm a Cheerleader. And I want to thank again the Physicista for being here. She got to be here in a very exciting episode.
Our first on-air clapping.
Yes.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much, and I know what I will be doing in 2 weeks' time. I will be watching and listening to this podcast again.
Yeah! Thanks for talking nonsense.
Thanks for talking nonsense.